Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Any way you look at it, the federal budget's an unwieldy beast. Almost $3 trillion worth of pet projects mixed in with entitlements and defense spending. And forget about the politics when you're talking about that much money. Congressional Democrats announced their 2008 budget plan today, but is it worth the reams and reams and reams of paper it's written on? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's the 16th of May today. The actual dollar amount's $2.9 trillion, give or take a couple of million dollars, an 11% boost for the Pentagon next year, about 5% on average for some of the other cabinet agencies. Congressional Democrats are also promising a budget surplus by 2012. We've called Maya McGinnis at the Center for a Responsible Federal Budget to help us explain the details. Maya, where do the Democrats figure they're going to get all that money?
On the revenue side, sort of the biggest issue is that they're also going to attempt to extend some of the tax cuts. And the plan there is that they're going to extend the so-called middle-class tax cuts, those for people with children, a child credit, people who are married, and the lowest tax bracket that's been brought down to 10%. And the real question is how they're going to be able to offset those costs. It's going to be quite costly to make those tax cuts permanent.
Right. And what they're talking about is something called pay-as-you-go. It's been a big thing for them since the election. How's it going to work?
Pay-as-you-go has really been the main point of fiscal discipline that Democrats have rallied around. And what pay-as-you-go means is that anytime you cut taxes or you raise spending on certain programs, and those are entitlement programs, things like Social Security and Medicare and veterans' health care programs, but any increases in those areas of spending have to be offset so they won't increase the deficit. That means that any tax cut has to be offset either by other tax increases or spending reductions. So the point that PAYGO brings us to is it doesn't fix our deficit mess, but it means that you're not allowed to make it worse.
Let me get you to the big line item that's only partially there in this budget. There's no money for Iraq and Afghanistan after 2009.
Right. The argument that people have put forth for not putting this in the budget is, well, we don't know how much it's going to cost, so we're not going to estimate it's anything. But, of course, if there's one amount we know that it's not going to be, it's zero. And the purpose of a budget is to kind of put your best estimates out there about what something will cost. And I think there's a real risk by leaving something so obvious and costly, such as Iraq, outside of the budget, is that the budget starts to lose its meaning. So what we've been doing so far is passing these emergency supplementals. Congress is working on one right now to fund the operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. And it would be a lot better if we could start bringing those into the budget so that the budget would actually be a snapshot of what we think realistically things will look like.
Political reality obliges me to ask this next question. The president has said he's going to veto any budget that comes in higher than what he had requested, and this budget does that. Where do we go from here now?
Right now, attention is going to shift from the overall budget, which is what they are working on right now and will pass this week, into the individual appropriations bills. And those are going to be coming out of the appropriations committees. They're going to be going to the president's desk. And in all likelihood, he will go ahead and veto bills that he thinks spend too much money. And I think this is going to set Congress up for a very contentious showdown between the White House and Congress for the rest of the budget season.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but the 2007 budget was never finished, and that was with Republicans in charge of Congress and the White House as well.
most people in the country probably would never have even noticed that we didn't have a budget this year. But what it reflects is that it's very difficult to pass these budgets. It was important from a political perspective that the Democrats passed this budget as they took over control in the House and the Senate, and they were able to do that. It is going to be important, again, that they get their appropriations bills passed, and in all likelihood, we will probably start the new fiscal year without all those appropriations bills passed and in place, which means we'll have to turn to some kind of more general funding revenues to keep the government going.
For the second year in a row.
For the second year in a row, and we have done it actually a number of times in past years. In the big picture, the budget process is actually breaking down. We have a whole set of rules and guidelines and timetables for how the budget is supposed to be passed. And we are, with frightening regularity, starting to miss all of those. That may be a sign that it's time for new rules.
Maya McGinnis works for an organization called the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. It's part of the New America Foundation. Maya, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Americans are entering a new round of the argument we have with ourselves every now and then when we don't like something that another country's doing. To vastly oversimplify whether we should put our money where our mouth is, use our investments to apply economic pressure for moral ends. Iran's the target of the latest divestment campaign. Some states are trying to get their pension systems to pull investments from companies doing business there. And today, Congress got into the act. Marketplace's Steve Tripoli tells us who's saying what about divestment this time.
The divestment debate's hot around the country, but let's focus on California, where CalPERS, the nation's largest public retirement system, is taking heat. CalPERS spokesman Clark McKinley says divestment would cost about $800 million in fees and lost profits. He says there's nothing the giant fund can do about divestment as things stand now anyway.
Despite our concern about terrorism, the bottom line is that we have a constitutional mandate, a requirement, to maximize our investment returns.
But Republican Assemblyman Joel Anderson says this isn't about CalPERS' mandate. He's sponsoring a California bill that would require divestment.
I expect them to use good judgment, and clearly they have lacked it on this issue.
Anderson says CalPERS should get out of Iran because it's a bad investment. That's why he's forcing the issue. Anderson says Iran's nuclear program, its threats to Israel, and harsh rhetoric toward the U.S. make investing there risky.
Generally, when you make statements like that, you either end up getting bombed, nationalizing assets, or having sanctions come against you. Any one of those three items is a reason alone to divest from Iran.
Ohio is having the same fight, and eight other states are considering divestment bills. The federal bill introduced today is sponsored by three Democrats, including presidential hopeful Barack Obama. It contains a safe harbor provision for pension and mutual fund managers. That means investors would be barred from suing the managers if getting out of Iranian investments means settling for less than maximum returns. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
CEOs are supposed to get the maximum return for their shareholders. Of course, it hasn't always worked out that way, sometimes for honest reasons, sometimes not. And so we have Section 404 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Law. That's the one that requires companies establish internal controls to stop financial fraud in its tracks. Abiding by 404 has cost companies millions of dollars and plenty of hassle over the past couple of years, but a survey out today reports those costs were down 23% last year. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
This year's drop in costs is thanks to companies' internal efficiencies. Michael Kanjemi is president of Financial Executives International, which published today's survey. He says although overall costs have fallen, one stands out.
Unfortunately, the external audit costs have pretty much stayed the same now. They may have reduced their hours and increased their rates, but the total dollars expended is pretty much flat.
And he doesn't expect audits to get cheaper in the future. Despite the survey's good news, 78% of executives still feel the costs of complying with Section 404 outweigh the benefits, which isn't surprising, says Matt Kelly of Compliance Week.
It's easy to quantify the costs, but the benefits of Sarbanes-Oxley are a little bit more ethereal, like greater investor confidence in your financial statements or fewer incidents of restatements or things like that.
Right now, only large companies have to comply with Section 404, but at the end of this year, smaller companies will have to sign on, and they may be in for a shock, says Stephen Bainbridge, author of The Complete Guide to Sarbanes-Oxley.
A lot of these costs that this survey is looking at don't scale, and what I mean by that is they're pretty much fixed costs regardless of how big the company is.
He says some smaller companies will face compliance costs that could eat up 10 to 30% of their annual profits. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
All deals all the time gave Wall Street a shot in the arm today, and not just the Dow, the broader markets advanced as well. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's not just Iran that's the target of a divestiture campaign. U.S. firms doing even indirect business with Sudan have been on the receiving end of protests as well. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway and the mutual fund giant Fidelity are the two best known. Today, Fidelity said it will reduce its stake in state-owned PetroChina by 91%. China buys close to two-thirds of Sudan's oil exports, and Beijing's been criticized for not doing more to stop the genocide in Darfur. Wars in Sudan have almost always been over scarce resources above ground. But Gretchen Wilson reports there's a much quieter and more fundamental conflict developing for what may or may not lie beneath.
Camel drivers in Darfur used to take their herds through age-old migration routes. Now they push them further south to follow the receding belts of grass and water. That puts them in direct conflict with farmers and other herders, who are all scrambling for the same scarce resources. And that's just the turf war above ground. But lines are being drawn for what's beneath the surface. Abdul Rahim Hamdi is Sudan's former finance minister.
The geological formations in Darfur are conducive to exploration of oil. You may find oil there, because oil is in Chad, oil is in the south.
There's no seismic data yet of the amount of reserves, but a U.S. Department of Energy official told me there's a very good chance that there are commercially viable oil reserves in Darfur. The U.S. says it has no diplomatic or economic interests here. Joel Mayberry is a spokesman at the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum.
Really, our focus is responding to the humanitarian crisis and urging Sudan to cooperate.
But President Omar al-Bashir is skeptical. He says U.S. humanitarian efforts are really a guise to overthrow his regime. Increasingly, analysts point to Iraq and say U.S. interest in Darfur is about gaining leverage in an oil-producing state. Right now, the U.S. can't do business in Sudan because of its own trade embargo, designed to put economic pressure on the government. Again, Hamdi.
They want a weak government, which they can control or which they can influence. Darfur is a political problem designed to cripple the regime and, if need be, to crush it.
French, Chinese, and other oil companies aren't restrained by these sanctions. They're in a pole position if Darfur's resources open up. If reserves are proven in Darfur, it could turn the tide in that region's conflict. That's what happened in Sudan's other war, a long-running civil war between the north and south. After oil was discovered in the 1990s, both sides there agreed to stop fighting in order to collect the oil revenue. Malik Agar Ayar was a leader in South Sudan's war against the north and is now the investment minister.
Peace is a key in any country, not only in Sudan. I mean, wherever you have, you don't have a peace, you don't have a development, and you don't have a capital that is flowing in, because why would somebody putting his money in a sinking boat? Why would an investor do that?
The same logic could foster peace in Darfur. Like the South, rebels there say they want a share of the money that's concentrated in Khartoum. Under the shaky peace agreement signed last May, Darfurians would have the right to share in any oil wealth. But some say peace isn't necessary to pump oil, especially if you do it on the sly. Sipa Mandla Zondi is director of the Africa Program at the Institute for Global Dialogue.
In many cases, maximum exploitation of oil resources using private international companies has thrived when there is chaos, when there is instability, when there is not democracy, when there is dictatorship.
Zondi says while South Sudan's oil revenue is supposed to be split 50-50 with the North, no one is really watching to see who gets what. Most observers agree the South isn't yet getting its fair share. And the same could happen in Darfur.
Oil has become a curse in Sudan and makes it very difficult to bring about a resolution of the situation there. That means Darfurians are unlikely to see serious move towards peace simply because they have oil.
No one knows how much oil is in Darfur or how much could be coming out. And this will likely not be the last battle fought over Darfur's resources. There are already rumors of rich deposits of uranium and copper. In Khartoum, Sudan, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Coming up, have you gone to a Tupperware party lately? Yeah, me neither, but a lot of men have.
The main reason that I even said I would sell was actually for the discount.
But first, let's do the numbers. For the eighth time this month, the Dow Industrials ended the trading day at a record high. Private equity mania and a flurry of investment activity by some closely watched market gurus helped push the Dow up 103 points. That's 0.75% to 13,487. The Nasdaq climbed 22 points, 0.8% to finish at 2547. The S&P 500 also rose 0.8%. Total of 12 points there to close at 1514. Stock in Citigroup surged by 4%, its biggest jump in 4 years. Investors piled in after hedge fund manager Edward Lampert bought more than 15 million shares of the world's biggest bank. Johnson & Johnson led healthcare stocks higher after Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway nearly doubled its holding in the leading maker of health products. J&J shares gained 2%. Bond prices were slightly lower. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 4.71%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board reports its monthly index of leading economic indicators. British Prime Minister Tony Blair spent some time with President Bush at the White House. This is Blair's last official Washington visit before stepping down. And will the price of gas keep families from road tripping this summer? AAA and the Travel Industry Association of America unveil their summer and Memorial Day travel forecasts. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Count yourself fortunate if you've arranged your summer vacation already. Not that you've done the planning, but that you get the vacation time at all. A study from the Center for Economic and Policy Research released today points out an American vacation void. It says the United States is the only advanced economy that doesn't oblige employers to offer paid vacations. Jeremy Hobson reports now from Washington.
In France, citizens have a legal right to 30 paid vacation days and holidays. Same goes for the workers in Finland, and they get at least 20, mandated by the government, in all of Western Europe and Australia. The U.S. is in a class by itself. Economist John Schmidt compared the laws in 21 advanced countries. He says the U.S. is the only one that does not guarantee workers paid vacation days or holidays.
About one in four workers in the private sector, for example, have no right to paid vacation whatsoever. That's about 28 million workers in the private sector.
For those Americans lucky enough to get vacation, they get an average of 15 days. That's less than the minimum standard in 19 other rich countries. Schmidt says there's no downside to leisure time.
Being generous with respect to paid vacation does not have a negative impact on economic performance, and it has a big improvement in the quality of life.
Which is why Schmidt says the government should not leave it up to private companies. But Steve Davis, an economics consultant for CRA International, disagrees. He says the fact that the U.S. doesn't have a vacation law is a good thing.
I don't think it's proper for the government to impose a one-size-fits-all policy on employers and workers.
He says those kinds of negotiations should happen at the company level. But does all work and no play pay?
The United States has higher income and higher earnings than, say, countries in Western Europe, in which these policies, mandatory minimum holidays and vacations, are common.
And truth be told, those who get paid vacation often don't use all of it. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Private equity's plan to take over the world continued today. Bausch & Lomb said it's going to be bought by Warburg Pincus for $3.7 billion. You know, it's the folks running those private equity groups that get the really big paychecks. But even entry-level jobs right out of school come with some sizable salaries, which in turn makes paying down those college and graduate school loans all the more manageable. Commentator Robert Reich thinks we ought to level the student debt playing field.
One of my former students who graduates from business school next week has already landed a job with a private equity firm paying $240,000 next year, which I can tell you is a lot more than the salary of his former professor, who's more than three decades older. My student tells me with a smile he'll be able to pay off his student debt way ahead of schedule. But that's not his real reason for taking the private equity job. He wants to make gobs of money. On the other hand, several of my students who will graduate next week tell me they would have liked to go into social work or into the nonprofit sector or provide legal services to the poor. One had his heart set on becoming a painter. Another became passionate about archaeology and had wanted to go on a dig in the Sahara. But they can't do any of these things because they have tens of thousands of dollars of debt. They need jobs that pay the rent while they repay their loans. When they begin their university studies and take out college loans, most students don't know exactly where their interests lie. That's what college is all about, discovering what you want to do with your life. But America's increasing reliance on student loans to pay for higher education is directing millions of young people away from what they really want to do, from careers that could contribute a great deal to their communities and to the nation as a whole, but don't get them out from under their college loans. So here's an idea. Make repayments of government-subsidized loans depend on how much money they earn. Say, everyone has to pay 10% of their income for the first 10 years of their full-time work, and then the loans are considered paid off. My student who's landed that private equity job would pay 10% of his income for 10 years, which would be a hefty sum. My students who go into social work or become artists would pay 10% of theirs, which would be far less. The private equity guy would, in effect, subsidize the social worker and the artist. And why not? This way, all of them could follow their callings.
Robert Reich used to work for President Clinton. He's got a job now teaching public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Your comments are welcome no matter where you work. Click on the link that says Contact on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. IBM's doing it, Caterpillar's doing it, and today, Tupperware did it. It announced a $150 million stock buyback program, the kind of thing a company does when it's feeling pretty good about itself, which Tupperware is. 61 years ago this month, it started selling those plastic storage containers. Those famous parties gave women opportunities they'd never have dreamed of in patriarchal post-war America. But the Tupper world is changing. For one thing, more men are selling the product now, and not just in somebody's living room. Marketplace's Sean Cole has more.
Not only are more men selling Tupperware these days, last year at least three of the top 10 sellers in the country were men, including this guy.
The main reason that I even said I would sell was actually for the discount.
His name's Joe Hagen, and he's always been thrifty. So when he found out at a Tupperware party that sellers get 35% off all their cake takers and modular mates, he was hooked. And then Tupperware came out with a cookware line.
And being in the restaurant business for 10 years, I was like, I have to have that cookware, you know? And so all of a sudden, I'm like, okay, well, I got to start having parties, and I got to have friends over and try it out.
He was kind of a natural, enticing people with door prizes, showing them a good time. And in a way, none of this is really that surprising. It's 2007. Men cook, women run for president. And yet, Tupperware as a company didn't seem to know that. Joe says a lot of the documentation he got as a seller referred to him as
she, her. Even when I filled out the first agreement, it said her, you know? So I crossed all this out in my agreement and put his and so forth.
But Tupperware is catching on. At its annual jubilees, it's made a few adjustments for men who win sales prizes.
We did recognition on stage. In the past, it was usually necklaces and crowns. And we said, wait a minute.
This is Rick Goings, the CEO of Tupperware.
They still like crowns, by the way, but they want a king's crown. No tiara.
Goings told me less than 1% of Tupperware's global sales force, global, they're in 100 countries now, are men. But the fact that he even mentioned a whole number is a big change from the 50s. And he says the nature of the job has changed, too.
Now we've re-engineered the opportunity so that you can not only hold parties, but you can, in fact, build your own sales organization. So that's attracted a lot of men to the business as well.
Not only that, but every seller has her or his own website now. And about a year ago, not very many sellers were taking advantage of the internet yet.
A lot of women didn't see that as a revenue for sales.
But Joe Hagan did.
I thought, you know, I could start doing advertising and getting people to go to my site. Well, I had no idea of the impact.
He put a sidebar ad up on Google and started pulling down $20,000 and $25,000 a month.
A month.
He'd go to Tupperware events and everyone would be buzzing about him.
Like, how is he doing that? He's a guy. How can he do that?
And then more people started doing it. And more. And then another guy started trying to push his fellow Tupperware sellers out of the market. Joe says the guy basically stole their internet customers and fraudulently drove up their advertising costs.
And I spoke to one woman. She ended up paying $11,000 in like 1 week from abuse that other consultants were doing to her. You know, it became a very much a war ground.
Tupperware ended up changing the rules for online advertising, which ended the war. Nonetheless, Joe says the unethical guy was the number one seller last year. And Joe was number two. Men have arrived in Tupperland. Even the rapper Ice-T, one of the toughest guys in the world, held a Tupperware party for charity a while back. And then he went on late-night TV and talked about how much he loved it. Rick Goings was watching.
And then he kept saying, and Tupperware is OG. And I turned to my wife and I said, honey, what in the world is OG? And then I find out it's old gangster.
No, it's original gangster.
Is that original gangster? Excuse me, how did you know that?
Well, under the circumstances, I think a better question is, how did you not know that? In Boston, I ain't no superhero. I ain't no Marvel comic. But when it comes to the game, I'm atomic and dropping it straight, point blank, and untwisted.
No imagination needed, because I lived it. This ain't no f***ing joke. This shit is real to me. I'm Ice-T. O-G.
O-G. Original gangster.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, it pays to be a well-connected political insider, as much as 25%. A Georgia State study from 2004 showed U.S. senators make about that much more on their portfolios than the rest of us do. It's not clear if the supersized returns are because members of Congress are smarter or because lawmakers and their staffs have access to inside information. As it stands, they're not bound by federal insider trading laws, but soon we might get a chance to find out whether smarts trumps access. Today, two House Democrats introduced a bill that would ban insider trading for both members of Congress and congressional aides. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 103 points, up 0.75%. The Nasdaq rose 22 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 picked up 12 points, also 0.8% there. Our engineers include Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, and Joel Stein. Next time on the program, what happens when the land your home is on gets sold right out from under you?
I wasn't expecting it. I had no idea that the park was up for sale. And all of a sudden it's sold. And I have to find some place to go.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.